Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. I am joined today by personal finance expert and former financial advisor, Joe Saul-Sehy. He's the host of a fantastic podcast called Stacking Benjamins. And keeping it very on brand, he's written a forthcoming book called Stacked. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here with you.
Look, I'm regretting my bio immediately because I said you're a former financial advisor, like you got Madoffed or something. You stepped aside to pursue other things within the industry. I make it sound like you have like a mark on your license or something. My bad.
It was a two-step process. I had a mentor that when I was about to turn 40, wrote. And I was at a big organization. I was with American Express and Ameriprise. And he wrote this like 2 weeks notice letter, which, as you may know, nobody does in that industry. It's much more of a Jerry Maguire. You take the client files and race everybody to call the client. Right? But he writes this great letter that said, listen, I believe I only have one life to live. I want a fulfilling life. And while I really like financial planning and I believe in it, I think I've got, and he said, this is his quote. He said, I have other mountains to climb. Mm. And it hit me. And it also hit a bunch of other friends that I worked with and that worked with Chris, this gentleman. And I remember going home after getting that, because it just stunned me that this guy that was so good at his job was going to leave the business. And I told Cheryl, I'm like, you know, I always wanted to be a high school teacher. And I had this practice managing about $60 million. So not a huge practice, but not a tiny one. And I knew I could get a nice bag of money for it. So I sold my business at 40 and started working toward becoming a high school teacher and a track coach. I never finished it. While I was bored in school, I started blogging, doing financial blogging, and that led to the podcast. And here we are now. But one other short thing. Chris, by the way, when he said he had mountains to climb, not only climbed Mount Everest twice, but he's climbed almost all of the major peaks on Earth. So he was being completely serious. Now he runs an adventure travel company, loves what he does, and so do I. So,
wow, very, very cool story. I think more people should do that. It's kind of wild to me that you're expected to graduate at whatever, 24 years old, and then do the same thing for the next 50 years until you can retire. I mean, just in my whatever many 14 years since graduation, like I've been a therapist and a behavioral specialist and a few other things. So it's been fun. And I can't imagine doing the same thing for 50 years. So I think we all have other mountains to climb. So you're a good example that way. So you have a book out called Stacked that's going to be released 3 days after Christmas, December 28th of this year. We're getting in early. We're getting in early on the promotions. You know, as a recovering academic myself, we were always told that if you're going to write something, if you're going to research something, if you're going to write something, it needs to fill a hole in the literature. What is the hole in the literature that Stacked fills?
I feel very lucky because I've gotten to see the hole. We have a show that comes out 3 times a week. I feel very blessed because we've had about 60 million downloads to this point, which is just amazing and humbling that many people have listened to us. But I definitely have seen the hole, and the place the hole is, I believe, is not passion around the topic of money, and it's not the seriousness of money, but there is a playfulness. And certainly you're a guy that you look at your TED talk that embraces playfulness, but I just don't see enough of that. And the whole inspiration for the book, I think, came from a different place that most of the people I interview, their inspiration came from. My inspiration came from this. I was walking through this giant bookstore, Powell's, in Portland, Oregon. And if you've never been there, it is like a block long. It's amazing. And I love getting lost in bookstores because it feeds my brain with all these ideas. And I wander over to the kids section and I see my favorite book when I was in fourth grade, which was the Hardy Boys Detective Manual.
Yep.
I carried this thing around. It was written by written with the help of a real retired FBI agent. And the Hardy Boys would learn how to, tail the bad person or do the fingerprinting or crack the code. And my brother and I, we devoured that thing. And then when I got home from that trip and came back home, my mom had been at my house while we were gone and had left on my kitchen table this box of stuff. And I was 50 and she was finally letting me have like my old Little League pictures. My third grade bowling trophy, my dad and I did this bowling thing together, tournament. One of the arms was missing. But the other thing that was in there was the Cub Scout Wolf Guide. And the Cub Scout Wolf Guide, I still think is awesome because it starts off with the tools you'll need. And then it goes through step by step what you need to do, the thing. And then at the end, like modern day video game today, right? When I was a kid, I would try to do these achievements at the bottom. And then there's a place for your mom to sign it at the bottom that you did all the things. And immediately I thought, what if I had this guide that's for adults, but combines the passion I had for this detective manual combined with the campiness of the wolf guide. And so Stacked, your super serious guide to money management was born. And by the way, I got that same question from people as we were doing this huge auction process for the book, which was pretty intimidating and maybe for another show. But every editor said there are no funny money books. Like they're just, there's books that embrace some humor, but there's not one that starts from humor and works down. Why is this different? And my viewpoint on that is twofold. Number one, I believe in the science of play and that we're going to learn more if we don't think that we're learning. I learn a ton when I'm not having it shoved down my throat. Mm-hmm. If I'm enjoying myself and I'm having a good time, I learn. So as an example, I love board games. There's a board game called Power Grid. And get this, for an exciting game, it's about setting up a network of utilities across the United States. There couldn't be anything, Dr. Daniel, there could be nothing more boring than that, but it's a really fun game. It's kind of like Monopoly. And I'll tell you, I didn't learn anything about a power grid playing that game. But now every time I read the paper and there's anything about solar or wind power or coal or anything, I dive into it because of the fact that I was having fun when I was first introduced to this. So that's number one. Number two is there's some super scary statistics around money now. And the biggest one is 65% of people in America in a recent study said that they've cried about their money. And by the way, you would think that that is poverty related, which is true. More poor people have cried about their money than people with high income or high wealth. But people that self-reported that they made over $250,000 a year, or I believe had $2 million or more, about 46% of those people had cried about their money. So while it isn't as prevalent among wealthy people, that's a lot of people that still have this incredible emotion around money. And I believe strongly that the way to break through that is I think we have to laugh and we have to laugh about our mistakes, because otherwise we get buried in our mistakes and we get buried in the stress of money and we don't move forward. And as you know, better than most people I've ever talked to, it's the behavior moving forward that gets you ahead, not being perfect.
Well, I share with you an enthusiasm for Encyclopedia Brown and the Hardy Boys growing up. It turns out that solving crimes has been a much smaller part of my adult life than I might have thought at the age of 9 or 10. But so it's very exciting for me to see that you took that template and turned it into something that's practical. And, you know, in a more serious vein, like, the literature is there to say that humor increases the stickiness of learning. And yet I couldn't point to a single funny money book. And thank you again for not calling it funny money. That would have been very lame. But I can't think of a single funny money book. And so I really do think you are filling a great gap in the literature. So I want to talk about a couple of big ideas from the book. The first of which is what you call your one idea to rule them all. And this is a timeline to your goals. Now, I've written a book, not funny at all, about goals-based investing. What do you think changes in a person when they move from sort of what's hot investing, which is very topical right now, to goals-based investing?
I think it's such a powerful thing. I think it changes everything, right? Because I think the average person starts from this point of view. What should I do? And we should ourselves toward all of our financial goals. And we end up getting nowhere because we don't know why we're in the investments that we're in. And I think a big key to understanding your money is understanding why you have the things that you have. And I look at investing like planting a garden. And I'm not the best garden planner. In fact, I'm looking out my window because I planted just a few beans this year and only one has come up. So maybe not the right, but I did grow up in farm country in West Michigan and worked on farms. So this really fits. But if we know the end outcome, we know what we want and we work backwards, we can get rid of all of this angst that we have around, I got to know everything about everything. I don't know anything about crypto. Crypto's going through the roof. Maybe I need to know something about crypto, or gold has been doing well, or we're seeing this rotation out of tech stocks toward other types of stocks. Like you don't have to know any of that. The cool thing is, if I start with the end in mind, like Stephen Covey famously said in Seven Habits Highly Effective People, and we work back to today, we get this really easy equation. I need to save X amount of money at Y return to get the goal. So now I have these three factors, right? And I can play with all three of those. Let's say I can't save X amount of money. I can save less than that. Well, then I can play with the rate of return number, knowing that as I notch up that rate of return expectation, my chance of getting that goal starts getting a little fuzzier, but it also points me to a different type of investment than I would have had before. Or I can push the goal back if it's not that important to me. Or if I'm killing it, I can take less risk with my investments, because who wants to roll the dice if I don't have to? So I can let crypto go because I don't care, because I'm going to reach my goal anyway. So I can now start playing with these three things. And once I have those, then I know what investments historically, what rate of return historically has gotten me there. And instead of having to look at all this huge field of investing opportunities, I can look at just this small group of things that got me to my goal. And now the learning curve is so much less if I begin with the end in mind. I violated this, by the way, myself recently in my sandbox portfolio. I know better. I wrote this book. And so I'm flipping through things, looking for stuff for the show. And I've got this sandbox portfolio of stocks. And I see Michael Burry's favorite stocks. And if people that don't know Michael Burry, guy that was on the movie, The Big Short, Christian Bale plays him. He's this brilliant investor that kind of called the whole mortgage downturn. And he owned this mining stock. And you know what I did? Zero research, no idea why I was buying it. Michael Burry owns it, dude. I got to put it in my portfolio. So I bought some. I will tell you, as a guy who historically has loved beginning with the end in mind, and I invest that way, the amount of trepidation I've had about this investment has been huge. And the investment's done okay. The mine's done fine, but I don't know why I own it. I don't know what my time frame is. I have no idea the selling conditions. So while Michael Burry probably has all these reasons why he bought it and reasons why he holds it, I've got none. I just don't want what Michael Burry owns. And I'm probably going to make a huge mistake if I keep it in my portfolio for any length of time.
Yeah. Well, you know, ripping off Covey again, one of the things that he talks about is you have to have a big yes to be able to know what to say no to, right? And so once you articulate this yes, which is your why, you're able to say no to all the things on the periphery that don't matter. Now, this is probably my favorite idea in finance. There's so much cool literature around this. My favorite piece of literature is that people who looked at a picture of their children for 5 seconds before making an investment decision save twice as much as a control group. So like in a very literal sense, you know, putting that why in front of you, getting that goal in front of you was very powerful. But we also know from the literature that that only works when it's a visceral, salient, powerful goal. And you ask the average person, like, hey, what are your financial goals? And they kind of shrug their shoulders and they go, like, I don't know, like retire, be rich, you know, drive a Lambo. Like, I don't know. How do you get people to move from these sort of mimetic goals that they saw on, you know, keeping up with the Kardashians or that they inherited from their neighbor or something, and get them towards these more visceral goals that matter to them?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because the whole time I was a financial planner, the 16 years I was working with families, that dude drove me crazy. That absolutely drove me. So what do you want for yourself? I just want more. M-O-A-R. I want more, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What, as much as I can get. Well, let's talk about your goals. I don't really need goals if I got more. If I got more, I can get whatever goal I want. So why don't we just cut to the chase, big guy, and tell me what the hot investments are and we'll go there.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, so then I would have to backtrack that that's not the way that wealthy people got there. And I had to have some examples of how wealthy people get there. Certainly, somebody like Warren Buffett is easy to point to, that he's got a filtering of investments, right? He wants to own investments forever, and he's lucky he can do that. But you and I can't do that because we will expire at some point. So if I start with the end goal, then I can be wealthy whenever I want to be, or I have a chance to be. Mm-hmm. I take away that chance by getting rid of the goal. So for my more analytical clients, I would have to walk them through this truly is how to get there. Mm-hmm. But for most people, I would do something that I learned from one of the top advisors I ever worked with, which was called the Deli Counter Approach. And I think we can do it with ourselves. Like if I ask you, what are you saving for? Like I do at the beginning of every meeting. So exactly what are you saving for? The first two things you'd say if you have kids are retirement for me, or me and my spouse if I'm married, or you know, me and whatever. Or I'm saving for my kids' college. Like I'm saving for those. And it was either college first or retirement first. Financial planners like me, I thought of those as the Puritan ethic goals. Everybody's saving for those. In our society, we kind of have to. So that's, it's rote. It's like you hit the hammer on the knee and you see the reflex, right? Those goals don't move the needle for a lot of people. If they do move the needle, it's got to be much more specific. My son really wants to go to Carnegie Mellon. So let's focus on this college, because I really want to have that in our family for him. Make it, my son's 25 and has already been through that. But that's a very specific goal. In retirement, people would tell me, well, I want to travel and play golf. I'm going to send you out to the golf course every day for 6 months. And I guarantee by the end of 2 months, you're going to tell me, I got to get off this golf course. Just because I can't. Same thing every day. Like it's got to be much, it's got to be more tangible, like a sweater you buy at a department store or something. So the Deli Counter Approach is this. I would continually ask, what else, right? You go to the deli counter, you say, I want some ham. They give you some ham, ask you if it's sliced right, pop it up on the counter. First thing they say is, what else? Mm-hmm. What else? What else? And I would keep saying, what else, until I got to the thing, right? Mm-hmm. The second house, the really, I don't care if I have another job. I just want to be out of this job.
Yeah.
I can't afford, I work 12 hours a day. I just want to do something more flexible, or I want to take more vacations with my family. These things that a lot of people sometimes don't think of as money goals, but money's the fuel for, I had to get to that. And once I got to the pulse of that, then I could flip the conversation to how are we going to fund that? Because that's a specific goal with a specific time frame. And even though we can try to get more with the rest of it, let's just try to fund this specific thing to make sure that you get this. And once they get on board with that, I'll tell you, at least the people that I interfaced well with, that became exciting. It went from this boring, oh, we're going to talk about goals, this is warm fuzzy, to, oh, I get it. This is going to drive the bus. This is going to drive everything.
Yeah. And you can tell it's a qualitatively different thing when that person has that emotional breakthrough, they stumble upon that goal that is really meaningful to them. You know, I've had that conversation a million times as a therapist. You ask someone, you know, how are you doing? And you get the knee jerk response of, you know, oh, fine, busy. And then you're like, no, how are you really doing? And you know, the voice starts to crack a little bit, a little pause, a little emotion. You can tell when you've gotten to that goal, when you've gotten to that emotional content, it's qualitatively different than I'm saving for retirement. I just want more. I'm saving for college. Because when you said that, I'm like, retirement and college. I mean, those were the first things that came to my mind, but those don't move the needle much for me behaviorally in terms of getting me excited. Because I mean, you know, my kids, you know, screw them. No, just kidding. Of course, children, you're going to college. But yes, it doesn't excite you in the same way that, you know, these more visceral things that you talked about with the deli counter approach.
You have to be able to see it.
Yeah, you do. Okay. So the second big idea, moving on to the second big idea from your book, this is a weekly money meeting with your spouse or partner that you say occurs over either pancakes or wine, depending on the time of day. Joe, I got to be honest, this doesn't sound fun. I mean, the pancakes sound fun. The talking with my wife about money every week sounds less fun. Are you trying to make me do something hard here?
I am trying to get you and everyone. By the way, our meetings did not start fun, but they're fun as hell now. And we absolutely love them. And there's some keys to get through it. And I'll walk you through those to make it fun. And the pancakes or wine are also meant to make it fun. But before we had our weekly meetings, here's what would happen. And by the way, what I'm trying to avoid, I'm trying to pull a Sun Tzu. I love the ancient book, The Art of War, right? And Sun Tzu says the best battle is the one that's never fought. Mm. And what I realized was that Cheryl, my spouse, and I were fighting a battle all the time that we didn't need to fight. And a lot of couples are, or if you're managing your money with someone else are, or even if you're not sitting down at a set time every week to have your own money meeting just with yourself, that you're fighting these battles with people around you because you can't afford to do stuff when you want to do it. And that battle is, in my family, it was this: one of us knows where every dollar is and is taking care of all the expenses. And the other person is in a place that I call fantasy land, which is it's all being taken care of. Everything's going to be okay. And what would happen is, and this is sad because I was so busy managing other people's money, I was the person in fantasy land in our relationship. Mm-hmm. So I would come home with stuff that I thought we needed for the family. And this is back in the early days when money was very, very, very tight. And I'd come home and Cheryl has these shopping bags with clothes for our kids. And we'd have this massive fight about the stuff I bought that I thought was important versus the stuff she bought that was clearly important. And why did we do that? So the weekly money meeting was meant to avoid that fight. And it's very simple. All we do is we take out our favorite app, and I've used different apps. I try out a lot of different things. Right now we're using something we pay for called Tiller Money, but I've used Clarity Money, which is now Marcus Insights. We've used YNAB. I try a lot of them just because of the podcast, but we take out the app, we take a look at the expenses that happened that week, and we just kind of walk through them. By the way, no judgment. If you've got judgment involved in that, you got to park that, because if there's judgment in the expenses, you're going to end up having some very big fights. But just walk through what you spent money on together, and then talk through what you're going to spend money on the next week. Twice a year, also bring in the investment statements, but only twice a year, bring in the investment statements and take a look at those and make sure that your asset allocation, we call it, is correct. And between those, bring up things that you should look at. And what we started finding was our phone bill was higher than it probably should have been. And so we together decided which one of us was going to call Verizon. And then we ended up saving a ton of money on that. We also found out that our package for internet was grossly overpriced. And there was another company in our town that was less expensive. And we started cutting expenses. And by the way, these little tiny wins that we had turned into bigger wins, but that wasn't the cool part. The cool part was actually, once we started talking about it with increased frequency in 20-minute increments, by the way, if it goes longer than 20 minutes, you're doing it. Don't make it this 4-hour summit, right? It's got to be 20 minutes and then you let it go. Wherever you're at, just let it go after 20. But what happened was we started with this frequency. We started having better money conversations all week long. Like it just naturally continued the rest of the week. And we'd start then planning ahead on the bigger expenses. And so not just looking a week out, we'd look a month out or 6 months out or whatever. And we were avoiding the fights before they happened. And it was amazing. And next, and then we went from there to working on a family mission statement, which is a whole different level. But I felt like these little wins of just meeting for 20 minutes a week and making it fun and light. Look at the expenses. Look at what you're going to spend money on the next week. Ask yourself a few basic questions about what are we really spending money on? What are we headed toward? I think it solves a ton of problems.
So I want to talk about the judgment piece. So when I look back over my own relationship, there's certainly some you know money conversations that I'm not proud of. Times when I use excessive judgment. Judgment was used on me. But then on the other hand, isn't there a line where an expense could be excessive or it could be frivolous or sort of out of the lines? What do you do if one member of the partnership is really spending more money than you have or spending on things that are sort of gratuitous or wasteful?
I think you have to handle it like you have to look at yourself as if you're the CFO of a company. And I think that you have to be at a place where you both look at it that way. Meaning that if somebody is overspending, I think you do have to ask the basic question, how do we afford that? Because you can look at the income and the outflows just carefully and analytically, not judgmentally, just say, we have X amount coming in. This money's going out. This math doesn't work. What goes? And let's ask each other. And by the way, if that's broken and you can't get past that point, I think that's when you need a third party in the room. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a financial planner. It could be a budget coach. It could be a therapist, but I think you need somebody. If you can't have that basic discussion that outflows are passing our inflows, I think that's when we've got bigger marital issues.
No, that's a good yardstick. So the last of the ideas, there's many more ideas, but look, we're not giving them away for free. We got to move some books here. Okay, people. We got to move some books. So the last idea we're going to talk about though today is automation, huge behavioral upside to automation. Why is it so powerful, do you think? And how do you recommend folks use it?
I am horrible with money. And it's funny to hear, I'm sure for a lot of people to hear a finance person say that I'm rotten with money. I'm the opposite of what Dave Ramsey talks about. Ramsey says that if you have plastic in your wallet, that you will use more, and studies show that most people do. I will feel guilty all day with the plastic in my wallet. And I'm showing you my billfold right now. I never carry cash because I feel a huge sense of shame when I spend plastic and guilt, and I feel none when I spend cash. I have no idea why. I just know me, right? So automation for me, what it does is it's a way to hide money from myself. And when I was a financial planner, if you can hide money from yourself, you will win. I'll give most of your audience, if they work for other people or if they've set up a retirement plan through their own business, look at how much money you've been able to save there. Mm-hmm. It, for most people, it's the number one place they're able to save. Second, look at the equity in your house if you've lived in a house for any length of time. The two places people save are the places where you're already hiding money. So what I like doing is not reinventing the wheel. Like we have these conversations, and I'll go back to an example I used from our money meeting discussion, which is we saved $50 a month on our internet cost, right? Not for some family, that's huge. For me at the time, not huge, but it was wasteful spending. And if I didn't, finding that is great, but if I don't capture that money, it's just going to get blown on something else. It won't be internet, it'll be meals out or whatever, because it's just going to be some money that I didn't capture. But so number one, identify, but then number two, capture it. And the number one way to capture that is immediately the second that we saved that $50, I went immediately to our automatic deposits into our mutual funds. And I raised it by $50, saved it here, got it saved over there. And now I never have to think about it again. It's funny, you and I have both talked to many people about the number of things that we can handle in a day. I'm thinking about one woman, Laura Vanderkam, who we've had on our show a few times, who talks about how the most successful people in society operate, like how they plan their day. And they have this battery. She explains it as a battery. And you've only got so many decisions in you a day. And if I'm wasting time every month saving that $50 for thinking about it one time to set up the automatic savings, and then I never think about it again, it frees up my mind to continue to bring in more stuff, either that I love or stuff that's going to make me more, if that's my goal. And I'm not thinking about this little crap.
Yeah. The thing that I love about automation from a behavioral perspective is that it flips bias on its head. Right. So we know that as a human race, we're status quo prone. We know that we're lazy and forgetful. And there's a lot of ways that that can get in the way of you saving adequately for your future. Right. Like all those things can work against you. But you can actually take your laziness and your status quo proneness and your forgetfulness and lock it in. I got an HSA statement the other day. I'm like, I totally forgot I had this HSA. And it was doing well because I hadn't been there to muck it up, right? And so use forgetfulness and status quo proneness for your benefit. You know, there's this idea that's from the Bible, actually. I call them River Jordan problems, after the story in the Bible where Naaman goes, he's a leper, and he goes to his local holy man and he says, you know, look, you got to heal me. And the holy man says, okay, right on, go bathe in the River Jordan 7 times and you'll be healed. And Naaman, who's this powerful guy, is like, bathe in the River Jordan. The River Jordan's gross. Like the River Jordan's gross and dirty. And like, what kind of suggestion is that? And that's lame. And like, there's better rivers all around here. Why would you send me there? And Naaman's servant says to him, you know, look, if he had asked you to do something difficult, you would have done it. So like, give it a shot, right? And he does, and he's healed. And I liken it to so much behaviorally about our financial lives. A lot of times when I or you or people like us suggest to people like, hey, you should automate things, people kind of roll their eyes at that advice because it's like, okay, you know, okay, genius, like that's your big, you know, 8 years of college to tell me to automate my, you know, my investing. But, you know, the automation of retirement accounts has resulted in billions and billions in excess savings. And the auto escalation of retirement accounts has resulted in billions and billions of savings. And so this is one of those River Jordan ideas that on its face, you kind of roll your eyes and go, okay, automation, not a big deal. No great insight there, but it is so powerful.
It's also worked against us, by the way. I'm reading a great book of stories called Business Adventures. Mm-hmm. And the third story in the book is about the IRS. And one of the miracles about tax collection in the United States is when they took that out of our hands, self-reporting, and instead had taxes removed at the source, before we saw it, most of us have no idea the amount of money we're taxed. And yeah, it works better in the United States than in almost any country on earth. If not any country on earth, we have one of the best tax collection systems on earth. And it's because of the fact that it's all been automated. And we don't even think about it. It's just automatically taken out.
No, it's a great point, because now I'm a W-2 employee, and it's a different experience than when I was self-employed. And, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, I would write a fat check to the IRS and be spitting mad, right? Versus now, I'm like, oh, every 2 weeks, the money just shows up, right? It's a very, very different thing. Okay, so the last question here I want to talk about is, you have a unique angle on an important question, which is how to find a good financial advisor, having formerly been an advisor yourself. I'm a huge advocate, and I've done quite a bit of research on sort of the upside that can accrue to people, especially behaviorally, from working with a financial professional. But that said, of course, not all financial professionals are created equal. And, you know, most 99% of professionals out there are ethical and good and want the right things for their clients. but there's still that 1% that's dangerous and you want to steer clear of. How would you advise people to go about the process of selecting a financial professional with whom to partner?
Even among, by the way, those people that are great and do a great job, they're also just are bad fits, right? They're just, sure. You know, because if I'm going to have somebody who's in my corner, there might be a bad fit. So I think it's three things. The first thing I like is always to work from referrals, but I need to be careful about who I get referrals from. I want to get referrals, not from people that are like me, but that for people a little bit up the ladder that are a place where I want to go. Because if somebody is advising somebody that I have a lot of respect for, this person probably had to pass through their filter already. Does not make them good, and it shouldn't be the only person you interview. But working from referrals, I think, is my number one thing. Ask, and by the way, if you don't have those people in your life that you look up to, it can even be people now online, right? Sure. People like you and me know a bunch of good financial advisors. I can point people toward people as people that they may consider that I think might be a good fit if I know the person a little bit. So reach out to people even online that you admire. And now a lot of financial advisors work virtually. So not being in your town is not the big deal it used to be. That's number one. Number two is once you get this list of people and you've worked to narrow it to maybe three or four, I think you have to interview three or four people. Because whenever I hear stories about, well, I hired a financial advisor and they sucked, there's only one of two things that could be wrong there. Number one is, and this is usually the premise that I see from online communities, is that means all financial advisors suck and nobody needs one, right? Mm-hmm. Which if you think about that, the idea of having bad people in your corner is horrible, but having nobody in your corner, but clearly you don't need to reinvent the wheel. And having people that have been there and know and are not emotionally attached to my goals makes so much sense to me. I want to be the dumbest person in every room I go into. I want to make sure that I'm being fed this good stuff that will help me climb whatever ladder that I'm on. So if that ladder is money, then I want to know people that are smart with money and can help me be smarter, but are not emotional like I am. Susie Orman, by the way, in her first book said that nobody's going to care about your money like you. I totally agree with that. Nobody will. It's your responsibility. However, she followed that up with, that's why you should do this yourself and not have an advisor. Like, that's ridiculous. I don't need an advisor to be emotional. I need somebody who's not emotional about my goals, who's going to kick my ass about all the stuff that's in my blind spot.
Right.
So either all financial advisors are bad, getting back to that point, or number two, my interview skills sucked, right? And I picked wrong. So I got to think about, what am I really looking for in an advisor? And I need to establish some great interview questions. There's great interview questions at the CFP website. We're certainly going to have them in our book when the book comes out. But the questions the CFP has are often around the things you hear everybody talk about online, which is, how do you get paid? Where do you make your money? Who do you work with? What's your track record been? Some of those questions, by the way, drive me crazy, because I don't think those are anywhere near as important as the fit. Hmm. I think the fit, what is your belief system about life? What type of people do you work with generally? How often are we going to meet? When I didn't interface with my clients, it was generally because their expectation of what I was going to do and what I expected I was going to do were two totally different things. And I learned, because I love Sun Tzu, as I mentioned earlier, as I got better at my job, I would cross that bridge at a time by saying, listen, this is exactly what you should expect. We're going to meet twice a year. I'm going to call you twice a year. And by the way, you won't hear from me anytime besides that. But that doesn't mean that you can't call me. And I've had people that have gotten mad at me when I was a financial advisor because I didn't realize I got a raise and they had all this extra money sitting around, or I didn't realize that something was messed up on the IRA. If you don't call me, I'm not clairvoyant. But hiring me allows you to call me and interface with me whenever you have questions. And I'm as lazy as the next person. I would be very happy to do less work and make more money. That is a kick model. But when you pay me, it's a retainer. So take advantage of the fact that I'm in your corner. You know, it's tax time. You want to run it by somebody. I'm not a tax pro, but I see a bunch of taxes before you send it in. If you want me to look at it first and just somebody that knows you. Yeah. Love to do that. You're going to buy a car. I know a lot about that. So give me a call. So back when I was a financial planner, I think that looking at those expectations beforehand can solve the vast majority of problems I see that people have. But I think also that if you're in that first meeting and you think, well, they seem nice, but there's something weird, I would always trust that spidey sense and go interview another person.
Yeah. So a couple of comments there. This idea that no one cares as much about your money as you, you know, my research has found that people are more emotional about money than they are even things like the conversation of death, you know, conversations around sex, like all these, you know, politics, all these other things that sort of excite us. Money is the most excitatory of all. And that doesn't lend itself to sound decision-making, right? So yes, on the one hand, no one cares about my money as much as I do, but no one cares about my car as much as I do either, which is why I pay someone else to fix it because I don't want to screw it up. So that whole idea, I think, is backwards. It's precisely because we do care so much about our money that we need some distance from it. And the second thing about FIT, I couldn't agree more. I know I've said this on the show before, I'll continue to pound this drum. When you look at therapeutic outcomes, the number one predictor of psychological, like psychiatry and psychologist visit outcomes for patients is the rapport between a client and their provider, right? Between the psychologist and the client. It's not how many years they went to school. It's not their theoretical orientation or any of those other things. It's none of the technical chops. It's do you like them and connect with them enough to follow their advice? And there is every reason to believe that that extrapolates to the world of financial advice too. A financial advisor is first and foremost a behavioral coach, someone who's going to keep you out of your own way. And if you don't like to be with them, you're not going to respect or listen to them long enough to get the value out of their relationship. So I love that. So Joe, before we go, I got to have my Barbara Walters moment with you and say thank you to you. You were one of the very first people when I was starting out to welcome me onto your show, which is obviously a big deal, 60 million downloads. I mean, I have the number 183 most popular show in Finland, so I do know what fame is like a little bit as well. But 60 million downloads, and you were one of the first folks in the industry to welcome me and give me a platform. So thank you for that. I'll return the favor now in some small way. If people want to know where they can pick up Stacked, where they can find your podcast, where they can follow you, point people to your stuff.
Well, thanks again. This has been fun as always. Every time you and I talk, we have a great time. And just to pull the curtain back, we must have talked for 15 minutes and I laughed my head off during the 15 minutes before we pressed record. So that's always great. So Stacked comes out December 28th. For every author, as you very well know, pre-orders are super important for the bestseller list and for other people to find it. And I want people to read the book, but I also want to spread financial literacy. You know, you can take your show, my show, Dave Ramsey's show, all the shows, and nobody still is listening. And so the more we can spread the word about great financial habits, it just lifts all ships. So I would recommend getting 10 as belated holiday gifts for, you know, your entire tribe or 100, you know, stack. It's, you can find it at stackingbenjamins.com/stacked, all the places to pre-order or go wherever you go. If you go to Amazon, that's fine. I prefer Bookshop or your friendly local independent bookstore, but wherever you go to buy books, you can pre-order it and you'll get yours the second it comes out. Yeah. You can find the show every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We call it the greatest money show on earth because it's a circus, as you very well know. We talk about a lot of different things. We know a lot about money, but we also, just like the book, have a lot of fun just talking about different money headlines. One thing I like about our show, we share a TikTok video every Monday that has some just absolutely brilliant advice. And by brilliant, my tongue is way in my cheek that we found somebody who is saying that, hey, you got to buy, the latest one was this guy that said, you got to buy this obscure crypto because his friend recommends it and his friend has a Lambo. Well, he wouldn't take advice from anybody, but the dude's got a Lambo. So you should buy this crypto.
Listen, Michael Burry follower, I think you're throwing stones from a very glass house, sir. No, the best follow on Twitter right now is TikTok investors. There's a Twitter account that posts the worst financial advice from TikTok. And it's like, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. It's very bad. So yes, absolutely. Check out the show. Everyone that listens to my show knows that I have been really on a soapbox lately about supporting creators, you know, folks like Joe who are putting so much great stuff out in the world, most of it for free. You can support, you know, folks who are like Joe, who are spreading financial literacy by pre-ordering the book. And yes, as an author, I can confirm that it is a very, very big deal for the book getting the kind of recognition it deserves. So go to your outlet of choice and make it happen. Joe, thank you so much for being here. A blast as always. And we learned a ton as well. So thank you.
Thanks a ton to you, man.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.